Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Personal Finance Podcast. I'm Deputy Personal Finance Editor Taha Lokhandwala, and joining me today are Emma Agerman. Emma, how are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
And Rachel Winter, Senior Investment Manager at Killick. Rachel, how are you doing?
Morning. Hello.
So it's been an interesting week. I'm sure everyone has realised market volatility has returned. It's been interesting if you've got some allocations to equities, I suppose. Things haven't been great, but have calmed down slightly this morning, but we'll see how that goes during the week. In my experience, two things happen when you get market volatility. The first thing is that fund managers all claim that they predicted the fall, and they will happily send you emails telling you how much they predicted the fall, despite the fact if you go through your inbox, there's nothing to suggest anything otherwise. And the other thing is they all try to give definitive answers as to what has happened, and they always tend to be different, which makes me think that no one really knows exactly what is happening. But on that note, I suppose, Rachel, what do you think has been driving the market falls this week?
Well, I think at the moment there are a few things to be concerned about. So we've got these tariffs, we've got concern about the auto sector, we've got the Italian budget. So all those things are kind of bubbling away in the background. But I think the trigger, the reason the market's come down so much this week, is very much what happened back in the first quarter of this year. So back then we had some very good wage growth data from the US. That caused investors to be concerned that wages would start rising more quickly than expected. Then they thought, oh, that's going to feed through to prices, we're going to have more inflation. And then the Federal Reserve will raise interest rates, and that will bring the market down. So I think back then, that's why we had that fall. And this week, I think we've had a very similar situation. So last week, we had Amazon raising wages to $15. And I think people are worried that perhaps other companies will follow suit. That will lead to a much higher rate of wage growth in the US. And we know the Federal Reserve has said many times over the last few months that the reason they haven't put rates up more quickly in the past is that wage growth has been quite low. So if that picks up, I think we could see a steeper rise in interest rates, and that could bring the market down.
Okay, the Amazon point is quite interesting, because I think we've seen the bulk of this come from kind of tech stocks, and that's not just been the US tech stocks, it's been globally. We've seen the Chinese tech stocks come down as well. So is there any particular reason as to why these companies have been hit the hardest, or is it kind of just down to the fact that they were valued the most at the same time?
I think it's because they were trading on the highest ratings from a price to earnings point of view. So whenever the market comes down, you tend to see a greater fall in companies that are more highly valued. So over the last few years, throughout the current bull run, we have seen a very strong performance in highly rated stocks such as Amazon, Microsoft, Google, Apple, all of those. They were trading on quite high ratings, and now the market's come down, those have been hit the hardest.
Okay, in terms of the kind of trade war and tariffs, a lot of people putting down the market falls to this as well. But nothing's really happened, well, this week compared to perhaps 2 or 3 weeks ago, when you did see Donald Trump slap another band of tariffs on China. And markets didn't seem to react then. Like emerging markets, which have suffered the most this year because of the tariffs, seem to be perfectly fine. So it's interesting as to slightly delayed response. I think we spoke about it on the podcast that nothing had happened and we were quite surprised by that.
Yeah, that's true. And I think largely that's because Donald Trump had been talking about it for such a long time. And actually the most recent round of tariffs that we had, the $200 billion worth of tariffs, that was actually a bit delayed. So I think Donald Trump had guided to the market that he would be imposing those about 2 weeks before he actually did. So by the time it finally came along, I think investors were ready for it. And that's why the market didn't fall on the news. And same this week with the trigger at the moment for the market falling, I think, is because people are worried about interest rates going up. But when we had the last formal interest rate rise in the US 2 weeks ago, the market didn't react on that news, but it's falling 2 weeks later.
Fascinating. There's another thing that's quite interesting. A lot of people saying this is down to kind of US 10-year bond yields steadily rising. Obviously, that is a main indicator of the kind of risk people are willing to take in markets. But I picked up something interesting from Niall O'Connor, who's a manager of, unfortunately, a rival to yours, Brooks McDonald. But he does make an interesting point here. And what he said is that there seems to be a very strong correlation between the spread of US bond yields over German bond yields. So that's the higher US bond yield minus the German bond yield, and how big that figure is. So at the moment, it ranges between 2.1% to 2.4%, which is the highest in 30 years. But he also says that his research has shown that the higher that spread is of US spreads of US bonds over German bonds, that normally triggers an equity bear market. But the reverse is also true. So when the German bond is yielding more than the US, and however big that spread is normally kind of correlated to a bull market. I don't know if this is anything that you've ever noticed or come across before, if there's any kind of merit in these kind of theories.
I'll be honest and say that particular data point is not something that I've looked at before. But talking about these sorts of correlations, I think that's something we're really going to start seeing change over the next few years. I mean, I think the current environment we have, where interest rates have been so low for so long and we've got this very loose monetary policy, I think that's really skewed a lot of the correlations and a lot of the market trends that economists and analysts have previously relied upon.
Okay, great. And in terms of bond yields rising and, you know, this getting back to this or above this 3% mark, which everyone has always generally talked about as being this point of significance in terms of coming back to something more normal pre-financial crisis, what does it mean for the main asset classes that we're kind of invested in, like global equities, global bonds, emerging markets, UK stocks and stuff like that? Is it going to affect these? Should we be planning for something more?
I think you definitely should bear it in mind. So when rates go up, that does mean it becomes more expensive for governments and for companies to borrow money. So historically, it has caused a bit of a slowdown in the market. But you've got to consider how quickly you think the rates will go up. So yes, the 10-year bond yield has risen to about 3.2% over the last few weeks, and that's a lot higher than it has been over the last couple of years. But it's still very low in comparison to where it has been historically. So I think at the moment, money is still quite cheap to borrow. It's a very important bond yield, that 10-year US Treasury yield, because a lot of corporate bonds are priced off that. So if that yield is going up, that means it will also be costing corporates more when they want to issue more debt in the future.
Okay, great. Emma, you've been looking around to see what people have been saying about this. Back to the earlier point, again, claiming credit for predictions and giving reasons. What have people been saying?
Well, some of the reasons that have been put out, we've got an interesting one from the head of multi-asset at Royal London, Trevor Greaton. And he says the old adage, sell in May and go away, has some value. And since 1973, stocks have posted an astonishing 97% of their returns from October to April. And October itself is typically the most volatile month. And so he sees this as a pattern. This sort of what's been going on in markets recently kind of fits to this longer sell in May, go away pattern. And that his funds have actually been buying on the weakness, and he thinks that investors should be pay attention to that old saying that you should be fearful when others are greedy and greedy when others are fearful. So that's one comment. Another interesting one I thought was from Simon Edelston, who's co-manager of Midwind International Investment Trust. And likewise, he's also seen this as a buying opportunity. He says, I haven't seen equity markets panic like this in 8 years, and corrections on this scale are like shopping opportunities, and we'll be watching to see where things settle. So he sounds quite pleased about it all.
No, I mean, I suppose you can always look at it as a silver lining to every case. Mm-hmm. Another one I picked up was someone just saying that everyone seems to be panicking, but this kind of market fall we've seen this week is what, if you have been a long-term investor, as in before the financial crisis and in normal, well, I suppose, more normal financial conditions, this is a normal week, isn't it? You're going to have weeks where you go down 5% and then something else happens the next week. It's called normal volatility, is it not? Or is this something else?
I think going back over the longer term, yes, it is a normal level of volatility. I think, again, because we've had this really loose monetary policy over the last 10 years, that has lessened the amount of volatility that we've seen over the past decade. And therefore, I think investors are perhaps a bit less used to having volatility, and they do perhaps tend to panic a bit more than they might have done in the past. But on the other hand, I do completely agree. 10%, I don't think it is something to be overly worried about. I think it is a healthy correction. And even in the last couple of years, we have had several corrections of a similar size, the last one being back in March, not so long ago.
Absolutely. Okay, great. So maybe nothing to worry about, and next week everything will be fine.
But yeah, and I'd also just make one more comment, that when markets fall, you tend to find they rise very steeply after that. And actually, the best days the market has had in the past have been very close to the worst days. So I would warn people off panicking and selling out when the market is low, because then you're likely to miss the best days that might follow after that.
No, always great advice. Thanks very much for that. This takes us on neatly to our next point, which is actually about correlation. So the point you made earlier, that was quite interesting. So equity market correlations this week have actually been quite high, as we may have noticed. You know, it started in the US, it spread to Europe, Asia and the UK somewhat. This is actually unusual if you look at correlations over the last few years, where equity correlations have actually been quite diverse. But something else has been happening to correlations more generally. Emma, you've been taking a look at this in the magazine this week.
Yeah, that's right. So basically, correlations between bonds and equities in particular have been increasing. And I think Rachel's point about monetary policy is a big factor as to why that's been happening. So as a result of quantitative easing, that's pushed up prices in a whole range of assets. And as a result, so many things are expensive, both in the bond market and in the equity market. And so we're seeing correlations between these two types of assets increase. There's also been increasing correlation between bonds and other bonds. And again, that, I think that's probably very similarly related to the macro picture and quantitative easing.
Okay. So when we talk about correlations, How should we be thinking about this in terms of an investor? What should we be looking for?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point because investors are always told to be well diversified. And the idea about that is that you want to hold assets that will perform in different ways. So if one asset is going up, well, let's put it the other way. If one asset is going down, you'd like to have some protection. You know, obviously being well diversified means sometimes if something is going up, something else is going down. But overall, it should mean that your portfolio is doing well and it's you've got a steady kind of returns. So correlation is useful because you're seeing how closely assets, how closely related they are in terms of their behaviour. So it's basically the difference between whether assets are moving together or whether they're moving in different ways.
Okay, and so you go into this in this week's feature. The fact that everything, the fact that kind of government bonds and equities have become more correlated, what does that kind of mean for portfolio construction? I suppose I'll put that out to both of you. How do you think about this?
I'd say it makes it a lot more difficult because in the past, you'd know that when people were feeling confident, they'd buy stocks and shares. When people were feeling worried, they'd buy bonds. Therefore, if you had both in your portfolio, when the bonds are falling, the equities would be rising and vice versa. So overall, your portfolio would be much more steady. Now we've got everything moving in the same way. Things are becoming increasingly interconnected, more global. Everything seems to be moving in the same direction. And it's very, very difficult to create a portfolio that is truly, truly diversified.
Okay, Emma, any tips on how you can kind of go about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think Rachel's exactly right. It is harder. For my article, I spoke to various people and there's some suggestions were to increase cash because, if interest rates are going up, that means the saving rates on cash are actually going to be better. And cash is basically the only asset that is truly diversified from any other type of investment. So if you're a bit worried about everything else, being too similar, then cash is one option. Another option is to try and add more exposure to alternative assets, so things like infrastructure and renewable energy, and they just run on different patterns. I mean, renewable energy runs on wind power, solar power. That's going to be quite different to what's going on in equity and bond markets.
No, yeah, it's fair to say that the correlation risk that we've seen in kind of bonds and equities hasn't really taken place in infrastructure and things like that, has it? So it's quite good. I suppose the cash is quite interesting as well. I suppose it means that in situations like the week we've just discussed, it gives you kind of something to buy with as well, a bit of dry powder, as it's better known.
It does.
Okay, great. And moving on, what else have we had this week? Something interesting from the FCA, which is the Financial Conduct Authority, the Financial Services Regulator. Investors and listeners may remember June 2016, if you were invested in an open-ended property fund. What happened was investors became very nervous about the commercial property market following the decision to leave the EU. And there was a run on these funds and there's some kind of technical issues about how, because basically they are illiquid assets, so you can't sell them quickly to meet redemptions from investors. So some of them had to gate, which means closing off investors in the fund and out of the fund, suspending trading, so nobody can do anything until everything has calmed down. But the FCA weren't exactly happy with how asset managers handled that situation. There was a lot of mistakes made at that time. It was something that caught a lot of people off guard. So they've come out with some new rules. Emma, what have the FCA been saying about this?
So the new rules, the most important one is that they want to stop funds trading as soon as about 20% of the value of underlying assets in the fund become uncertain. And that would, as you say, become uncertain in times of market stress when we don't...
But basically, you mean the value of the assets?
Because, the value of the assets becomes uncertain. And that would be because we can't tell basically just the actual conditions of how to price these assets if markets are falling very steeply. It just becomes much more hard to actually figure out how much these assets are worth. And that, in that situation, that's when you get investors, as we saw after the vote for the EU referendum, just wanting their money back. And that is a problem for these funds because they're illiquid assets that they hold and they can't go out and sell them. So basically, the FCA wants to make it a much more orderly process where as soon as an independent valuer of the fund's assets says 20% of the assets are, you know, the value of it's looking uncertain, then the fund must immediately stop trading.
Okay, that's interesting because that kind of, it flips it round. So what we saw in 2016 was eventually after investors went, I'll call it a run, but it's not the same as a significant run that you get like a Northern Rock or anything like that. But went and run on these funds, they redeemed and then they gated.
Mm.
And it seems that gating used to be something of a seen as a last resort rather than what I suppose the FCA is suggesting is the first resort in the future.
I think that's true. I think that you know, no fund manager wants to be the first to decide that they're going to lock investors into their funds. So in some senses, understandably, funds don't want to be the first to do this. And that means that actually it becomes much more chaotic. And by having this rule in place, the FCA wants to make it much more straightforward and clear as to when a fund is going to decide to suspend trading.
No, good. Sounds like it might be positive for investors. Is this what do we think about the rules? Is this a good thing?
I think that, yes. I mean, in terms of it causing a more straightforward and orderly procedure, it will be a good thing, and arguably it will be fairer to different types of fund investors, because there's some people who want to redeem their money in that kind of situation, but there's also quite a lot of people who are quite happy to stay in the fund. But if a lot of people want their money back at the same time, the managers are going to have to go about selling assets to redeem the people who want their money back, and that is a problem for the people who want to stay in the fund. So actually, by having this rule change, it could mean that it's just more orderly and people know what's happening. So yes, I think that it could be fairer, but okay, we could probably see this happen more frequently as a result of this potential change that FCA is proposing. So it's just something for investors to be aware of.
Okay, the other thing that used to happen is that these open-ended, especially the commercial property funds, the big ones from M&G, LNG and Threadneedle, the ones that a lot of our readers will own, is that they used to have about, I think, generally about like 10% in cash, and this was to meet redemptions. The FCA suggested anything about this because it's a huge cash drag on investors' returns, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. So as you say, lots of these funds would have had cash, and actually as a result of what happened after the Brexit vote, lots of them are even holding even more than that, so you know, 15 to 20%. So that is going to have a big effect on the returns they're getting, investors are getting. So yes, I think that you're right, like this should mean that funds might not need to have that much cash because they've got this clearer rule as to when they would need to suspend trading.
Okay, great. Rachel, you're a fund buyer. What do you think about these rules?
I think they are a step in the right direction, so they do give investors a bit more security. But I actually think they don't go far enough, and I actually think the open-ended fund is a completely inappropriate structure for property. The point of an open-ended fund is that as an investor, you can sell out when you like and get your money back. But if I'm an investor and I sell £10 of my fund, it doesn't make sense for the fund manager to go and sell £10 of a property in the fund. It's just not possible. And as you say, for that reason, these fund managers have to keep loads and loads in cash, and it's just a very poor way to earn returns. So I think as a structure for property, it should no longer be allowed. I think the investment trust, or the real estate investment trust rather, is a much better structure for property.
Well, I mean, this is it's an argument we hear often, and obviously it's a completely valid argument. I wonder why these trusts ever became this popular. I mean, we're talking about £30 billion worth of pounds in some of the, and collectively across the industry. So there is a lot of money. So why have people been so kind of afraid of the real estate investment trusts? This seems more of a case in the the kind of discretionary fund bias space, I suppose.
It does. So I think because investment trusts are of a fixed size, they're quite a difficult vehicle for some very large institutional investors to invest in. So all these massive pension funds, if they're getting inflows of pension money all the time, it's quite difficult for them to put that into investment trusts, because those investment trusts don't always grow to meet the amount of investment that needs to take place. So I suppose if you are a big institutional investor, the unit trust or the open-ended fund is a preferable vehicle.
But they are still popular on the for private investors as well. I mean, obviously, IC readers do tend to favour investment trusts for all sorts of asset class, but you do see it pop up, especially in the portfolio clinic, that a lot of them do own these open-ended property trusts, property funds. So.
They do, and I think probably the appeal of that is that investors think, great, they can get their money back when they want to, but sometimes, as we saw in 2016, it doesn't work. So I think, from my view, the real estate investment trust is probably a more appropriate vehicle for an individual investor for property.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. And speaking of investment trusts, a nice little segue onto our next point, which is the Smithson Investment Trust. This is the new global small to, I'm going to call it, say, small to medium cap. I think small cap's a little bit unfair for this one. The new small to medium global equity investment trust from FundSmith. It's not run by Terry Smith. It is run by two new managers. Its offering ends today. It's been very popular. They've had to actually increase the IPO size. So I'm sure plenty of our listeners have already subscribed to this. But we go into a bit more detail on what's going to happen in the trust of stocks it's going to buy in the magazine this week. Emma, should we have a quick summary on what's going on?
Yeah, absolutely. So in terms of the kinds of stocks the trust is going to buy, it's going to really focus on cash generative software and technology stocks, consumer companies and healthcare firms. And that's going to be mostly based in North America, which is going to make up more than 50% of the fund. And there's also going to be a sizable weight in Europe, about 40% in that fund. In terms of the types of, it is more medium cap.
So I think it's an average cap of about 7 billion.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's going to be investing in companies with a market cap of between 500 million pounds and 15 billion pounds, but with an average of 7 billion. And that is more mid cap size, but it's much smaller than the average market cap of companies in FundSmith equity, which is 50 billion pounds.
Okay, yes, a very big difference. So how does it kind of compare to what else is around? Obviously it's been popular. Do we think it's going to kind of work in the, is it something different on offer?
Yeah, I think that it is something different on offer. And we all know that Terry Smith is obviously a very successful investor. He's got a massive following. So it's unsurprising in some senses that they've had to increase the amount they're looking for. And I think that, it was going to be a popular fund. In terms of whether it offers anything different, yes, because it's actually quite different to the global small cap investment trusts that are already out there. So examples are Edinburgh Worldwide Investment Trust and F&C Global Smaller Companies. They actually have companies on average which are much smaller than this trust is going to be investing in. So that's one big difference. And also the kind of composition that the companies that are going to be making up in the portfolio are different. This is more weighted towards tech and software, so it actually could be a bit of a different trust.
Those real Terry Smith favourite kind of stocks that we all know and love. Are there anything we should be wary of? Obviously it is popular, a lot of people have subscribed, but there should be some things we need to be looking out for with this.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you pointed out that obviously even though it's got Terry Smith's name on it, he's not actually going to be running it. And the trust is going to be run by two managers who are actually joined the company, Terry Smith's, FundSmith's company, quite recently from Goldman Sachs in 2017. And the lead manager has had some experience of running a concentrated global equity fund, but that only launched in 2016. So not too much experience.
Exactly a track record.
Yeah. A lot of analysts I spoke to felt quite confident that Terry Smith knows a good manager when he sees one. So
I believe one of them said he doesn't suffer fools.
Exactly. there's a sense that actually these managers should do a good job, hopefully. But I mean, it is something to be concerned about. Also, this isn't the first example of a of a sort of highly popular fund manager who's made their name in large caps, deciding to open a small cap trust. So we're talking about Neil Woodford, who did something similar with Woodford Patient Capital Trust. And so far, the results on that have been mixed. I mean, it is, as the title says, it's for the long term. He's usually about 7 years. So we haven't reached that point yet, to be fair to him. But so far, the results from that trust have been a bit mixed. So it's just a warning sign to investors that it's not necessarily always going to work out with a star manager necessarily.
No, people can overstretch themselves, which I'm not accusing Neil Woodford of doing, but there's an argument there to be had, I suppose. Rachel, what do you think about this trust from your side?
Very excited about it. Big Terry Smith fan. I know he's not technically managing the fund, but we know he's been very heavily involved in the assembling of the fund universe and the initial selection of stocks. He's worked very closely with the two lead managers on picking those stocks. And we know that the Fund Smith motto, if you will, is to do nothing. So we know that once they've chosen those stocks, they're not really going to change them. They'll just buy them and hold them. So in that regard, you could say, does it really matter that much what the two new managers are like initially? If Terry's been involved in the original selection, they're just going to hold those stocks for a long time. But that said, both managers came in to see us recently and they were incredibly impressive, answered all the questions very well. So I'm not concerned about them at all. And one more thing I'll say is that the first dealing day of the fund is the 19th. And arguably, that's a very good time to be launching, given the market fall that we've just had.
Yeah, it's interesting. So someone just made that comment on the website as well, actually, saying it was a fortunate, excellent timing. I did read the kind of prospectus on this, and the detail that they go into the strategy is quite compelling in terms of this, like the whole do nothing that you said, but the work they do beforehand, it's quite interesting. What I find interesting the most is to say they don't meet management. So I think every time we speak to fund managers, they often brag about how many meetings they do a year, and these guys are saying, well, we don't meet any because it's pointless. I don't know if you have any thoughts about which way it works from what you want to see from your fund managers.
I think for very, very small companies, it's definitely worth meeting the management. When the companies get larger and larger, I suppose it's difficult to get as much of an overview of the company from meeting the management, because perhaps they're not so involved in the overall workings of the business. I think it depends on your investment strategy. And we know that Terry Smith has a very strong accounting background, and their investment philosophy is just to look for companies that have very strong cash flow. So the original Fund Smith Equity Fund, that looked for companies with good cash flow, and the new one is doing exactly the same. So even though the new trust is focusing on smaller companies, the overall strategy is very much the same. The geographical spread is the same. The spread by sector is very similar. So we're very hopeful that it will continue to do just as well as the original Fund Smith.
Okay, great. Yeah, the cash flow analysis thing is quite interesting. There's a fantastic article from our IC's new columnist, Phil Oakley, on the website and in the magazine to read about that. So that's worth taking a look. And it's very similar to how Terry Smith thinks about picking stocks as well. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for this week, but thank you very much for listening, and please do head to the website and pick up the magazine for more on Fundsmith correlations and everything we've talked about this week. There's also a feature from Emma on healthcare, which is quite interesting if that's a sector you've been looking forward to. And thank you very much for listening, and have a good weekend.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.